Welcome to the Metal Hammer Podcast, episode 116. I'm Mo, and joining me today, Steve looks like he's trying not to laugh. What's so funny?
Just the way that you went from sort of normal voice to broadcaster voice, I just thought was...
It's called being a broadcaster, Steve.
So, that's exactly why I laughed as well.
Right, fine. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the Metal Hammer
Podcast. But you don't talk like that either, so...
Whatever. This is the podcast. I'm Mo. He's Steve. She's Al. Hi, everyone.
Hi.
Thanks for killing my vibe. I've got loads to get through today. We're going to be doing the next edition of the Metal Hammer Podcast Hall of Fame in just a bit. I think some interesting opinions are going to come out of this one, if what we've kind of chatted about briefly is any indication. Don't forget that the latest issue of Metal Hammer is out right now. It's a world-exclusive interview with Lamb of God's Randy Blythe. And we also recently unveiled some special Lamb of God bundles featuring an exclusive cover and an excellent specially commissioned art print by the one and only Luke Preece. You may have seen him doing art for the likes of Metallica and Ghost and Ozzy Osbourne, amongst others. We got to do a special Lamb of God piece just for this bundle. You can get that and the regular edition of the issue at tinyurl.com/buyhammer, as well as out in the shops if you happen to be out there at the time. I'm just going to shut my window. Give me 2 seconds. Talk amongst yourselves.
Oh, okay. Fine.
Oh, I didn't know this was still a thing. Uh-oh, Steve's eating delicious chocolate truffles.
Wow, that was some great time filling, guys. That was real pro
work. Snitch? Fucking snitching me and eating my chocolate. I thought we were breaking.
Oh, dear. Look. It's nice outside. I was going to try and have the window open, but some dogs started barking, and this has to be professional. So it's not happening. It's not happening. We're just going to all sit here and sweat. So yes, Lamb of God issues out now. tinyurl.com/buyhammer. If you go to the website that leads to my favorite magazines, you can also pick it up digitally, get it delivered straight to your device, get a subscription, individual issues. It's all there. As always, we really appreciate your support very much. We had some sad news to start off this week. News broke on Monday that Paddy Bowden, who is the estranged wife of Iron Maiden singer Bruce Dickinson, has passed away after what Bruce described in a statement as a tragic accident. And Bruce Dickinson's statement adds, "Our children, Austin, Griffin, Kia and I are devastated. Out of respect for Paddy, we won't be making any further comments at this hugely difficult and painful time for our family." Obviously, it goes without saying, but everyone at Metal Hammer here sends our love and thoughts to the Dickinson family. Thoughts with them right now. What do you guys think of this Serge Tankian news that's come out this week, that he's planning to release a new EP that was originally intended as System of a Down music?
Bit weird.
It is a bit weird, isn't it?
Yeah. I feel like, why couldn't it be a new EP of System of a Down music?
Sorry, go on.
Well, I mean, as if some of you might know, I've been listening to a lot of System of a Down recently, because there's something on the Metal Hammer website of every System of a Down album, not just every System of a Down album, but their other extracurricular activities ranked from worst to best. And unsurprisingly, I put most of the System of a Down stuff above their other stuff, because let's be real, as good as I think that first Scars on Broadway album is, for example, System of a Down are fucking brilliant. I'd kind of forgotten how great they were until I went back and listened to those records, because it's been such a clusterfuck over the last decade or so. Like, the live shows have been bad, the infighting's really weird, and like Dictator, that last Scars on Broadway album that came out, you know, that had been sitting there for 6 years. I just don't know what they're playing at. It's so weird. It's depressing. It's
some kind of what is very clearly a completely insurmountable creative difference going on, isn't there?
It was interesting.
We know they've both been writing System of a Down music, as in they being Darren and Serge. We know that's happened. We know they've both, as we're now confirmed by what Serge is planning to release, they've written stuff that they intended for System of a Down, but somewhere along the way they can't make these ideas come together to make actual System of a Down music. It's just crazy.
Then they shouldn't be a band, should they? I mean, that's don't go off and milk your back catalogue for loads of money and play these crap shows that you've been playing. Just don't be a band. Like, I'd rather they just split up and went, do you know what? We don't really like each other. We can't get on. It doesn't work. We're not going to do anything. I mean, they obviously, it's their music. They've got the right to do whatever they want with it. But it's so messy now that every year they are like diluting the quality of their own obituary, because it just gets more and more sort of ridiculous with every passing year, I think, System of a Down. And now when you hear this, it's like, oh, we were going to use this for System of a Down, but now I'm going to put it out anyway. It's like, ah, I don't know. I'm done with them now, to be perfectly honest.
What do you think, Al?
Yeah, it's just kind of annoying. It's like, if anybody read our top 50, top 50 metal bands as voted for by the Fair Readers of Hammer, we had a thing about System of a Down in there, and I was doing some research and going back to old issues of Metal Hammer, and there was issue 147 way back in the early 2000s, and they were talking then about conflicts in the band. And it's kind of interesting because I hadn't really known any of the background of that, about sort of how, just how different they were and how often they did clash. And so, you know, they were obviously, the seeds of that were there from the beginning, and it sort of must have got to a breaking point. And you just think, what is it exactly that just can't be resolved? You know, like, what is so terrible about their working process or the different directions that they just can't work that out? You know, that's like, what, almost 20 years ago now that they were doing that interview and talking about it. It's kind of mad. You know, other bands have sort of come through that and lost members or had members come back and sort of work things out over the course of two decades, but with them it's just complete silence. You've got no idea what's going on behind the scenes, what conversations are had. They're different people now to what they were 20 years ago, yet still these, whatever they are, these creative differences or personality clashes still persist. It's just, it's really interesting. Mm. You know, I'd love to know more about it, but they don't really give specifics, do they? They just kind of say it's not going to happen.
But that's not a unique thing in bands per se in general, is it? I mean, that's not like that's never happened before.
It's been so long. I think that's the thing that really brought it home for me reading this. It's been 20 years that they could, you know, people change so much in 20 years.
It's now longer between the last System of a Down album and now than it was between, it was how long we were waiting for Chinese Democracy.
Yeah.
It's mental.
But the thing is, it's like, no one says that about, I don't know, Caius. Do you know what I mean? Or because Caius, like, Josh doesn't want to do anything with Caius, so they're not a band. That's it. And, or, you know, the kind of the clamour for a Pink Floyd reunion that happened for years and years and years and years. It never really got properly resolved. It never happened. They weren't a band. Forget about it. But when you're actively going out and touring and paying, charging people money, and you're having to stand on stage with each other, it's such a weird conflict of, like, things that they're putting out. Do you know what I mean? They are, to all intents and purposes, still a band, but yet they just go, well, we have absolutely no intention of recording or writing or releasing new material. Like, you've got to be one or the other, haven't you? Surely. I can't think of another band that have gone, oh, we absolutely cannot write music together, but we are still, because we hate each other so much, but we are still a band. We are still a working band.
Mm. I just found the little bit that we published, actually. I'm not sure of the exact year, but it was early 2000s. It says that we interviewed three of them. I think it was Darren, Serge and Chavo. It says, all three interviewed members freely concede the arguments of Rock Systems vote. And then Serge says, there's been some military moments, a few commando incursions here and there. And then Darren, after a bonk hit, says, it's disturbing. There are moments of tension and people getting on each other's nerves. But things that might have broken up other bands haven't broken us just because of that closeness.
Well, yeah. I mean, that all just sounds like fairly standard band fare, doesn't it, really? As Steve said, I guess there's always going to be tension in bands. I think people, maybe a lot of people don't realise that once most kind of veteran bands get past their kind of third or so album, a lot of the time they're not like
best mates.
Best mates together against the world. You know, it's obviously, it's still something they pour a lot of passion to, but it's also their job. And a lot of time, you know, there's a lot of big bands in the world, probably most big bands in the world, who don't actually hang out with each other on their days off. or their time off. Like, that's not how the dynamic works. But yeah, systems are a weird one because they're just, it's, I guess it's hard when you know how brilliant a band have been and how passionate they've been and how important they've been. It's hard to conceive that, you know, they're all still passionate about music. They're all still passionate about politics. When you look at what Serj has done in that realm in the last few years, you can see that his passion for that kind of stuff hasn't gone away at all. But their passion for doing it together, or at least their ability to overlook their differences to make that connection happen, it's just not there. And, you know, I've seen them be good in recent years. I've seen them be not good in recent years live. Like, I'm still happy for System to tour because, like, you know, that's their job. If they want to go make money and people are going to pay tickets knowing what they're going to get, I think that's up to them. But there's still a small part of me that wants an album, but then I don't really know. I don't know. I feel like this Serj thing is going to be interesting for me because, to me, this is the first definitive actual, if what he's saying is true, and this is System of a Down music, basically, or was meant to be, I think it's going to be the first and maybe last definitive sign of whether System would have been able to produce something special. Because if he puts this EP out and it's like the best thing he's ever done as a solo artist, but you just feel maybe it's missing a little bit of Darren magic on there, then to me that says the potential is still there for greatness. But we don't know until we hear it, will we?
I don't even know. I mean, maybe you know, maybe you've read about it more, but when it says originally intended as a System of Down project, does that mean other members may have had input at some point, or does it mean he literally wrote this by himself?
I didn't get the impression other System members were involved, but I mean, they could have been. I mean, that's one of the things that other artists do quite a lot. I can't think of any off the top of my head, but sometimes bands kind of break up or go on hiatus, and then one of them will do a project and then they'll actually get some of the other members of the band in on that project. It always annoys me when that happens because it's just like, I'll just fucking do the project then. It would be quite funny if you just had a Darren like solo on this thing or something. You'd be like, oh, come on.
It makes no sense to go, like, I can't imagine, if they really aren't capable of getting in the studio and working together and doing, I can't imagine Darren being like, oh, you know, we worked on those songs, it didn't really work out. You have them, mate, you have them. Have them, like, you release them under your name.
No, yeah, it wouldn't have.
You know what I mean? Hasn't
Darren said it's got loads and loads and loads and loads and loads of unreleased songs as well?
Yeah, they've all like, got tons. The common dynamic seems to be, from what's been put out there, that there's Serj and then there's the other three. And I'm not saying we should blame Serj for any lack of System material at all, by the way. But there's, you know, I've seen stuff different members have said where they've all got in studio together and they've done stuff, but there's just that extra thing missing that would get Serj in as well and make it a full System of a Down writing session or whatever. But I don't know, man. Like, we'll see. They're one of the greatest bands of all time, and this, to me, this will be maybe a final indicator of if we even want new System of a Down music, let alone on if we'll get it. I'm hoping it will be good anyway. I'm keen to hear it. In other news, Marilyn Manson's official photographer, Peru, who we worked with at Metal Hammer on our last Marilyn Manson cover a couple of years back, he's releasing a new book featuring hundreds of photos he has taken of Manson over the years. Now, this guy has been in Marilyn Manson's posse for literally decades now. The new book is titled 21 Years in Hell. It's going to chart the singer's career since 1998, which, when you think about Manson's life and career across those 22 years, that's a lot of stuff and a lot of evolution and a lot of moments in his life that he could have captured. Yeah, interesting to see how this will turn out.
I may have an inkling of how it will turn out. And it may have turned out very well.
And you may be able to hear more about it from us very soon. Let's leave. Oh,
that was very subtle, Eleanor. What you were saying there.
I'm known for being subtle. It's my middle name.
No, it's not. let's do the album of the week, shall we?
Yeah.
Shall we? Yeah, let's do that. There's quite a few cool albums out this week. New Wolftooth album out this week. If you just like kick-ass heavy metal, listen to that new Wolftooth album. New Caligula's Horse album out. New Old Man Gloom album. ISIS guys involved in that, I think, and all sorts, if you're into that vibe. But we've done something a little bit different. We're going to review I think this is the fifth album, believe it or not, from a Norwegian band called Barren Womb. I was not surprised at all when I found out this band were Norwegian. When I saw the name, for some reason, I kind of thought it might be like a doomy, slow. What are you doing?
I was just going to big up one more album, if you don't mind, before we get into this, Merlin, because I didn't realise, can I just say, there's a band called The Ditch and the Delta, and their album is a self-titled album. It's fucking amazing. I didn't realise it was out this week. It's amazing. You have to go and listen to that band. It's absolutely brilliant. If you like Mastodon, crossed with Deftones, it's amazing. It's absolutely incredible. Anyway, go on.
All right, well, I feel like we've thrown this album under the bus now, but we're going to do the band.
I would have said this before, but I only just found out that it's out on Friday.
I didn't even know about this, so yeah. That's fine. Go listen to that album as well. That's really good. Like I said, there's loads of good shit, but we only got time to do one most weeks. So yeah, we're going to do this Band Room album. Now, if you like Larry gutter punk, occasionally slightly blackened, kind of hardcore meets rock and roll noise, think like a Vel Attack, think Every Time I Die, bit of Blood Command in there as well. I think you're going to like this album very much. What do you guys make of this record?
Oh, yeah, this is a bit of me, this record. I like this stuff in general. There's another Norwegian band that came out last year called Danger Face, who are a similar sort of thing.
And I like Danger Face.
Yeah, they're good, aren't they? They're really good. There's just something about this whole kind of Scandi rock, Scandi punk, hardcore thing, which is just super cool, I think. Sort of post Turbo Negro, there's been a whole bunch of these bands, and most of them are fucking great. Although I just like this type of music quite a lot, so I don't know how much you should pay attention to my opinion, because I'm not able to be that sort of balanced on it. Really, I just love this shit.
No, but I think this shit done very well. What did you think, Al?
Well, you mentioned Danger Face. I saw them at B-Larm, which was like weirdly, like a couple of weeks before lockdown. So I was in Norway in March, which wasn't even that long ago. And B-Larm is like an industry convention where they have kind of talks by people, and then in the evenings they have performances by up and coming bands. It's all genres, but they have a couple of stages just for metal. So I saw Danger Face there, and it was they're sort of like the Bronx, Cancer Bats, Gallows, etc. And it was just like really exciting, and listening to this record sort of put me back in that mindset of when I was at B-Larm, because there are a lot of kind of those types of bands playing on the metal stages. It's like, yeah, it's like, I don't know whether it's the Cavell Attack effect, whether it's people kind of seeing what they've done and then doing something similar. I don't really know enough about this particular niche, but it's just that thing of when you put the record on, it feels like a big live explosion. And I don't think this is as much my taste as yours, Steve. It's not really a record that I just maybe put on if I was sitting around. But if I was at a venue and a band started playing all the songs on here, it would be like really, really, really fun. And it just reminded me of that really fun live vibe. It doesn't sound particularly like polished or anything. It just sounds like a couple of people just doing a live thing and recording it.
This is literally a two-piece as well. So
yeah. Although they have got more than one guitar on things.
Yeah, yeah. Imagine it's like
they've obviously recorded other parts.
Yeah, exactly.
But it still sounds pretty bare, like pretty kind of raw.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting. They describe themselves as a Nordic noise rock duo. And noise rock is one of those things where I recognize it as a genre, but it feels like such a vague term sometimes. But I think what's interesting about this album that maybe you wouldn't say about acts like Cavell Attack, for instance, and you know, Every Time I Die and a lot of those bands, is that there's a moment here where I was thinking, like, you know what, you could play this in like an indie club and it would go off.
That's exactly what I thought, yeah.
Circle Jerk, definitely. It's really plinky plonky. It's like, oh, where did that come from?
The song Hairy Palms as well, it reminds me of those bits on the Blood Command, Blood Command has done a couple of albums. On one of the Blood Command albums, where they almost go a bit Arctic Monkeys with the kind of like bound down, bound down, bound 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 down, bound like kind of guitar tone. So that's really interesting. And it's weird because you just think a lot of these bands in a different world, you could really see them being absolutely fucking massive. It's just weird that they kind of can incorporate these elements into an album that still sounds like an alternative, urgent, heavy rock record.
Yeah, it's funny you say that, actually, because I listened to the singles before I listened to the album first, and a couple of those songs were released before the record came out, and I was a bit like, fucking hell, I'm kind of surprised that Merlin's picked this, because I mean, I was just listening to the new Strokes album before that, and that's really like quite heavily influenced by Talking Heads and that kind of early New York thing, which like I personally, I love, but I know you guys don't love it as much. So I was like, because, and when you were mentioning sort of, oh, you know, it's sort of Every Time I Die and Cavell Attack, I didn't get that straight away. I was more like, this is more like kind of, yeah, noise rock in, probably not as manic as something like Lightning Bolt, but maybe Death From Above 1979, who were a band who sort of, kind of like Queens of Stone Age do, they kind of straddle that line between, you know, they're like a heavy band that indie kids can sort of go, oh, I'm into metal, but they're also hard enough and rocky enough for sort of proper rock and metal fans to like them as well. That's what, that's kind of the genius, I think, of bands like Queens of Stone Age or Death From Above, or I guess even Foo Fighters as well. Not that I think this sounds like Foo Fighters really, but yeah, this is dead good, this record. Like, once I actually got the album in full, I thought it was much better. It's weird, I wasn't that keen on the singles, but when I got the record, and they're put within the context of the record, because everything else surrounding it is proper heavy, I thought those songs, which at first I was a bit like, about, were a hell of a lot better.
Yeah, they really pop. There's a lot of this album really reminded me of Wilson as well, which is a band who I absolutely loved.
First album.
Debut album, Full Blast Fuckery. If we'd been doing the podcast when that album came out, we would have been raving about it nonstop. They sadly broke up last year, but they were such a fucking great band. And they are another one that really honed that kind of scatty, hardcore, gutter punk sound into something that was so catchy and kind of more of a like rock and roll vibe. And I think
they call it punk and roll.
Punk and roll, exactly. Punk and bloody roll. And yeah, it's just really cool. And then, you know, there's a lot of different layers to it as well. We mentioned some of the stuff that goes into more indie territory. I love the, I talked about Blood Command, those kind of almost like disco punk kind of things they do with like the kind of rolling drum beats and that kind of really funky rhythm they get going. I love that. The tracker, Be Kind, Have Fun, and Try Not to Die. It starts off like a Wilson track and then it devolves into this kind of shimmering stoner rock jam. That's really cool. It's one of those albums that I think the first time you listen to it, you just kind of think, oh yeah, it's another of these bands doing more of this kind of stuff. But I think it's a little bit more varied and it's got a lot more layers to it than that. And I hadn't even heard of these guys before. The album's called Lizard Lounge, by the way. I don't know if I said that. But yeah, I hadn't even heard of these guys before this record. And I'm not that surprised that it's their fifth album, because they sound like a band that are really like found their groove and know exactly what they're doing, which is really good. So if you like the sound of that and you're into all those bands we mentioned, you should definitely check out Lizard Lounge by Baron Womb, which is out this Friday, via Loyal Blood. And then listen to the other band that Steve said, whose name I forgot already.
They're called The Ditch and the Delta. It's available to stream now, but the physical release comes out today if you're listening to the podcast, so you maybe buy it or something. But this album's really good. The Baron Woon album is really good. You can never have too much of that kind of greasy punk rock, sort of by way of old school rock and roll, I think. So, yeah, good
shit. Good stuff indeed. Shall we go on to the Hall of Fame? Is it time?
It must be time.
What did you say?
It must be time.
Oh.
What did you think I said?
I thought you said, let's be time. It doesn't matter. Let's all be time together. No, it is time to do the new Hall of Fame. I think most of you guys know how this works now, but just in case you don't, every so often, we will nominate an artist to be debated right here on the Metal Hammer podcast, over on the Facebook readers page. facebook.com/MetalHammerReaders if for some reason you're not there yet. And if you're not there, where have you been? So we nominate a band to be debated. We put all their albums up for vote, and the top two most popular albums by that artist, according to you guys, we then debate, and the album that we decide is most worthy goes into the prestigious and totally real and legitimate Metal Hammer podcast Hall of Fame. So far, including Antichrist Superstar by Marilyn Manson, Seven Son of a Seven Son by Iron Maiden, and the self-titled album by Slipknot. So big albums. And I don't think we can be too surprised by the two Korn albums that made it through to this. We're doing Korn, and it was the self-titled, the album that arguably invented nu metal, versus Follow the Leader, arguably the album that firmly consolidated Korn as the biggest and most exciting band in metal at that moment in time. Is that fair to say for both of those?
Yeah, I think
it's really fair. I'm going to be controversial and say these aren't my favourite Korn albums out of Korn's whole discography, but I can totally see why they made it to the top of the vote. It's reasonable.
Yeah, I mean, the vote, these two quite clearly won our vote. As I said, every album by the band was up for voting. These two won it by far and away. Issues was quite a clear third place after that. I was quite pleased to see Untouchables do well, which is my personal favourite Korn album. That was the first album that Korn released after I had got into them. And I think, for me, that was the perfect blend of those, like, heavy, horrible riffs with that kind of more highly produced kind of groove and almost like party atmosphere that they had going on in the later albums. They were just kind of starting to tiptoe towards that. Obviously, they'd done songs like Got the Life and stuff before that.
I was literally thinking of Got the Life. For me, that's because we were listening to these two records again. I was like, this is sort of the first one that where it really felt like the party vibe, even if it's like dark. It's definitely, like, get your boogie on.
Definitely. And yeah, so for me, like, Untouchables is my favourite Korn record because I think it took that a bit further and was the best thing. But, you know, these are probably the two most significant albums in Korn's career. I think they probably are the two albums that people talk about the most with Korn. And I think as well, you could make an argument that, you know, they're only 4 years apart, but I think you could make an argument for almost two different generations of Korn fans coming in through these records because... as much as the first one was groundbreaking, genuinely responsible for an entire subgenre of metal, arguably produced their most famous song in the form of Blind, Follow the Leader really did take them to a point where, like I said, they were the biggest thing in metal at the time. And just when you thought that they wouldn't, you know, come out with another song that could ever match something like Blind, they came out with Freak Unleashed, which is just... I mean, when I got into Korn, that album wasn't even their most recent album, and that was still the song that was still getting the most plays on video channels. So, yeah, where should we start? There's a lot to get into. That's what I'm trying to get at.
With the debut album, because it came out first.
What a good idea.
Can I also say, before we start as well, I think it's also worth saying that as good as the other records that you've mentioned that haven't got into this conversation are, I think it's also worth saying that the Nothing, the recent Korn album from last year, which is 25 years after they released their first album, is fucking brilliant. And there's not many bands that you could say that about. That is a great record. And I would have had no problem debating that as one of the best Korn albums. I don't know exactly how high in their discography it would have got, but I think it would have got pretty high. So I think you have to say well done to Korn just for quite a spectacular level of consistency over the years.
Yeah,
I was going to say the same, but about The Serenity of Suffering, which is obviously another recent one. I just love that record. That to me is second after Issues, I think, which was the Issues was the kind of the first one that I really came in on and like rinsed. Serenity of Suffering, absolutely love that record. And yeah, years and years and years after they began, and it's that formula really that we were just talking about of the sort of bouncy catchiness with the darkness, that album for me has really got that in that balance. Go Korn.
Yeah, just a brilliant band. Well, I mean, Korn are one of those bands where I kind of think, you like heavy music? Surely you have to like Korn. Like, how can someone not like this band? I love the fact that they had, you know, they had that weird mid-noughties period where they started getting loads of extra band members out wearing bunny masks and all that stuff and all that weird shit that was going on, which was interesting. But then I felt like just beyond that and kind of into the Path to Totality era and then coming back just after that, they kind of reclaimed their crown as one of the best live bands in metal. And I think they've been that way ever since. Like, Korn turn up on a festival set, you know you're going to get an hour plus of just... the best, most fun, most brilliant songs ever written. And I think maybe that's a good place to start with the Korn album, released October 11th, 1994. Of course, produced by Ross Robinson. Who else with that kind of nasty, like horrible kind of violence underbelly that this album has? When I think about what I love about Korn, and this is maybe giving away a big part of my opinion for this early, that whole kind of fun, swinging, groovy vibe that came into their music is just not really anywhere to be found here. And I don't know if you can say this is like an enjoyable listen a lot of the time, because it's, even now, it still sounds dark and horrible and just kind of genuinely uncomfortable, some of this album, which I'm saying is an absolute compliment because it's an amazing work of art. But what I listen to Korn for now, this album just gives me a totally different vibe.
Yeah. I mean, out of the three of us, I think I don't know. I suppose it depends where you do the cutoff, but I think the first two people kind of think there's this big change post Follow the Leader, and certainly live, having seen the band a couple of times before Follow the Leader came out and then seeing them afterwards, the difference in their live show particularly was massive. They were not a fun sort of good time festival band back when this album came out at all. Jonathan Davis never used to speak in between songs. It was like no audience patter at all, no wave your hands. They used to throw themselves around like the fucking Dillinger Escape Plan. It was a feral kind of live set, and I think they've definitely morphed into something which is much more enjoyable in the traditional sense of the word over the years. Not that that necessarily makes it better, but there really is only one Korn album that sounds like the first Korn album in their entire discography, and that is that first record. I think people also tend to sort of put Life is Peachy in there with it as well. I think even when you listen to Life is Peachy back to back with the first Korn record, there's far more sort of like Lowrider and Wicked songs that are fun, like weird little bits that are just a bit of a muck around, and bigger choruses, you know, songs like Adidas, which are a bit silly.
I mean, even opening the, I know we're kind of going off on a tangent here, but that's fine because we're doing Korn. Even opening their second album with a song like Twist, you know, yes, that's a weird song. And if you played that to someone that wasn't into metal, they'd be like, what the hell is this I'm listening to? But that's kind of got a bit of a mischievous thing about it. Just a kind of silly, kind of scatty, like 40 second song or whatever it is to start an album with. It's basically an intro, isn't it, that track? But it's just got a very, very different vibe to the wretchedness of Blind, which, okay, has become an all-time metal anthem now, but in and of its own. And I think also with the production on this first Korn album is so far removed from where they will go later in their career. Again, Ross Robinson doing what he does. And it just gives the whole tone of the record a completely different vibe. I think were all three of us at the Brixton show when they played it in full a few years back?
Yeah. Yeah. I saw them the week before headlining Hellfest playing it as well, so I saw them do it in full twice, which is interesting.
I agree. What did you think of that show, El?
I'm trying to cast my mind back and remember it now. Completely put me on the spot. I was actually just thinking about Ross Robinson, which to take it up another tangent. Because although you were saying sort of what he brought, you know, like he's doing his Ross Robinson thing, like this was really early for Ross Robinson. He'd barely done anything. Like, it's weird to think of how common a name he is now, or how big of a name he is. Like, he's as big a name as a musician in this world, like in the new metal world, the contemporary metal world. But back then, he'd barely done anything. He'd done like a Fear Factory album and something by Wasp Merlin, which he would be excited about.
Did he? I didn't know that.
Yeah, The Crimson Idol.
I love The Crimson Idol. I did not know what Ross Robinson did that album. Yeah. That's mad. I have learned something today. That is absolutely bizarre.
Yeah.
I'm actually going to have to Google this.
I wasn't there at the time, but I have read things sort of saying that this Korn record sort of made Ross Robinson, or at least sort of brought his name, you know, to prominence. And again, not sort of being there, it's hard to get a read on that. But if he'd barely sort of done anything before this, and then this came out, and you can sort of see how his reputation built and how he would sort of go on to do more of that like dark shit.
Yeah, I think Ross Robinson's a really, really integral part of what makes Korn, early Korn, Korn, obviously. He did, you know, he had done Fear Factory demos, I think, and a Deftones demo as well. Around the same time as working with Korn, so he always gets pegged as this kind of new metal uber producer, but I don't think that's a very accurate way to, I mean, I know he's done he did Machine Head and then he did Slipknot as well, and he worked with a lot of the bigger bands around this
was
time.
He was an assistant engineer on the Crimson Idol. Blackie Lawless did the main production on that one, that did, which is what threw me a bit.
So then, yeah, that's even more kind of like, he was even lesser known than maybe we thought.
Yeah, exactly.
Very, I mean, certainly Korn is his big breakthrough thing, but I do think the fact that he's worked with Blood Brothers and Glassjaw and Norma Jean and At Driving and all these other bands mean that he's not really just like a nu metal, the guy who just makes everybody sound like nu metal. Those bands wanted to sound like that. He happened to capture Korn, and Korn invented this entirely new thing. I don't think he... I think he certainly pushed Korn as and pushed Jonathan as far as Jonathan just to breaking point, pretty much, didn't he? But yeah. I don't think that that's where they wanted to go. Mm. I think. I mean, yeah. Well, that's where they needed to go. They might. I mean, I'm not sure Jonathan would probably like. You see in interviews now where he said, "Oh, Ross went too far and this and that." But I think he probably needed to go that way, and you know. If that record was kind of tempered or dulled at all, I'm not sure that it would be thought of as quite the kind of revolutionary thing that it was, because that's, you know, like Jonathan's performance on it and what he did was, and when you think about what metal was like in 1994, when you think of even the big contemporary metal bands, you think of, you never got that level of emotion from Rob Flynn or Phil Anselmo. You know, you think about, you know, Father and Driven came out that year, fucking Stronger Than All, Phil Anselmo, 5 Minutes Alone, and Phil Anselmo had become like the dude that all metal singers kind of want to emulate, and he's this macho, proper macho posturing dude, and then along comes this kind of skinny wimpy guy who likes Duran Duran singing about how he got bullied at school. Like, it's just so far away from what metal was at that point.
Reframed a lot of masculinity in metal, didn't it? Yeah. In many ways, this album, because like you said, like when you kind of got the likes of Phil Anselmo just being the ultimate chest beating manly man front man, you know, and then you've got this like little skinny kid who's almost literally crying into the microphone about stuff that's happened to him. It just completely changed the way men could feel that they could portray themselves as metal frontman, which is fascinating in of itself. I guess the main thing we're getting to is that this is an uncomfortable album. It's not a fun album to stick on, and I think people kind of default to this record being, you know, the definitive Korn album because it was so important and it literally changed music. But it's the only album in their whole career that I have to appreciate in a totally different way and listen to in a totally different way. If it's a nice sunny day outside right now, and Korn are a band that I would consider just like putting on while I'm like going for a run or just walking about, like enjoying myself, this would not be the album I'd put on to do that with. And I think that was reflected, to get back to my point about 10 minutes ago, when they played it in full, because I remember afterwards we were talking about it and we were kind of like, When bands play classic albums in full, you're kind of, especially a band like Korn, who was so good live and so exciting live, you're kind of expecting this like anthemic, like, oh yeah, they're playing all these tunes no one's heard in ages. Oh, this is so great. Yeah. But it wasn't really like that with the Korn record. It was quite uncomfortable viewing. And I mean, only the band could say this for sure, but I didn't really get the impression that they really enjoyed playing those songs again. Like Jonathan just didn't, you could see that he's not in the same headspace that he was at that point. It was 20 years ago, and who is, you know. It was a weird experience, wasn't it?
Yeah. The only thing I can kind of liken it to was, you're right. They had to almost do an impression of what they used to be. And the only thing that, I mean, I went to see the Manic Street Preachers play the Holy Bible in full, which again is a super dark record. And now they're this kind of stadium indie band or whatever. And watching those guys who wrote, you know, Design for Life and If You Tolerate This and all these like nice songs, having to go back and play these horrible, horrible songs that they wrote like 20 years before, they just, it was like them doing an impression of themselves. And watching Korn doing their album that night, it was like, well, yeah, you know, you're not that band anymore. You're just not. And that's fine. It's all right to not, but you know, they've evolved into something else. But it was, you know, sometimes maybe bands shouldn't play, they shouldn't revisit things. And watching Jonathan Davis do Daddy that night was like, I didn't need to see this, really. Do you know what I mean?
Anyone wants to see that, particularly, like, even when you listen to the record and you know that it's coming and it's like, you know that it's going to start playing, and then you hear it and you're like, oh, do I want to listen to this? Do I want to turn it off?
I never listened to Daddy.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. It's not a song I'm just going to whack on. I'm just looking at the set list now from that night, and I distinctly remember, yeah, they finished with Daddy, and then they went away and they came back on the encore, and the encore was Falling Away From Me, Here To Stay, and Freak On A Leash. And like, you could feel the release in the crowd. Like, yeah, when they kind of went on stage, it wasn't really like a, wow, that was fucking amazing. It was kind of like a, I'm kind of glad that's kind of done now, which, you know, is art should be uncomfortable. Art isn't there just to kind of make you have a lovely time, but the difference in the vibe in the room at Brixton, and I've seen Corner Brixton Academy many, many fucking times over the years. I'm sure you guys have as well. I can't remember the last time I saw a whole vibe in a room just change between two songs as they did between Daddy and Falling Away From Me. It was just like, all right, now we're partying. And then everyone just went off like you're used to at a Korn gig. A weird time to see them do that. But maybe testament to what an incredible album that was. In terms of being such a unique experience.
Well, I think the other thing that show showed up, which is sort of something which, I mean, we mentioned it a bit with the sort of front-loadedness of the Slipknot record, which people might have thought was a little bit controversial or whatever. I think even more controversially, what it shows up is that, you know, that Korn record, and going back and listen to it now, I think it's difficult to listen to it with 20 ears, because it has been aped and copied and watered down and, you know, manipulated by so many other bands for so many years, for so long. Like, you know, by the time nu metal reached its, you know, it was ready for the knacker's yard, how many people had nicked every single idea off of that record and tried to reappropriate it in some other way? It's really difficult to listen to it now without the context of 30,000 other bands who have sort of, you know, stolen bits and bobs from it and cherry picked their favorite bits of it over years and years and years. You can't really listen to it and hear it like people heard it in 1994, or, you know, like I remember hearing them in, it would have been just before Life Is Peachy came out, was the first time I heard Korn, and I just could not imagine what it was. I had no fucking idea, absolutely no idea. I was like, every single facet of this doesn't appear to have anything to do with the type of music that I've been listening to, but yet it is heavier than all the other stuff that I've been listening to. It's more affecting, it's more dramatic. There was nothing else like it, nothing else like it. But listening back to it now, the second half of it is, I mean, to put politely, patchy, very patchy. Like, and I remember that Brixton show, the energy level really dropped post kind of Chutes and Ladders.
Yeah.
The energy level dropped off a cliff.
That's exactly the same. After Chutes and Ladders, it's just like, there's not really anything else I want to listen to on it. Even like Divine before Faggot, I'm like, I'm not really that fussed. And that's why it's not like my top Korn record. But I do think, I do love the Korn aspects of this Korn record, which sounds like a stupid thing to say, but I didn't hear it when you heard it, Steve. I heard it obviously later than that, but it was like setting out all these Korn things, you know, scatting, bagpipes, that really low, low bass. Like, you're talking about sort of the lyrics, you know, sort of talking about how Jonathan's problems and kind of addressing all these issues with masculinity and how he wanted to be and like the underbelly of society. Like, when you look at the stuff he's writing about, I mean, we'll talk about it on Follow the Leader as well, like songs like Pretty, but it's just so horrible. It's so horrible. And it's kind of mad that like this was like a massive record when it's so horrible and the themes are so horrible. But yeah, I mean, I guess my point was, there's still things in there that are so Korn focused that I've never seen anyone replicate. Like, you know, even people always talk about bagpipes and bring back the bagpipes and all the rest of it, or the scatting, and it's like people didn't really replicate that bit of it. They sort of took the more saleable bits of it, I guess.
Yeah,
absolutely. Yes, it's weird because, look, yeah, of course, you're right. It was a massive album, but things would kind of accelerate for them significantly over the course of the 90s. Should we I want to say very briefly, because we are supposed to be only doing the two records, should we very briefly talk about Life is Peachy? Because I think it's quite telling that that album is in between these two. It's often overlooked. It's kind of written off. I think it's still loved as an album, but it's still just kind of like, titled as kind of like, oh yeah, it's a bit weird, like they went a bit experimental, they did some fun stuff on it, but anyway, then they went on to Following the Leader and all this stuff happened. Like, is that fair? Like, does Life is Peachy not get a fair look in, because it's an important part of their journey to get where they got to at the end of the 90s?
I really, really like Follow the Leader. Its highs are not as high as either of the two albums that I think we're going to talk about, but stuff like
Life is Peachy, you mean?
Life is Peachy, sorry, yeah. Life is Peachy is like Wicked on Life is Peachy is brilliant. It's completely different from anything else that they did or ever really did. Well, I say that they did kind of rap songs on Follow the Leader after this, but yeah, I think there's some really, really great songs on Life is Peachy. I was super excited. I bought it the day it came out. You know, Good God is amazing. No Place to Hide's great.
Adidas is huge.
Yeah,
I had the single of Adidas. It had five different versions of it, or something. Yeah, I know. Like, why did I have that? Like, why did I think that was a good idea?
Got to collect them all. You're not a real fan. That's what it is, Alan. That's what you have to get, every single version. That's what you need to release, like, seven different singles and every fucking.
It wasn't even very good. Like, it was just, what was the point of it?
I'm looking at them now. There was a Adidas Synchro Dub Mix, Adidas Under Pressure Mix, Adidas The Wet Dream Mix. I tried to think what that was. No one ever wants fucking bonus remix versions of songs, do they? Why do bands do this? I've never understood it.
That was just a good way of making extra money and getting yourself higher up the chart back in the day, wasn't it?
Fair. Which, you know, I don't really have a problem with. I guess we're agreed that Life is Peachy was, you know, a decent album, had some great moments on it. And then they really kind of went for broke on album number three. Follow the Leader, released August 18th, 1998. You know, at this point in time, nu metal as a genre has gathered real pace. Steve's talked about it before when we talked about Slipknot, how, you know, you could almost argue that the genre was already starting to run out of steam, certainly its first generation. And then Korn come along with this album that is this kind of huge, bouncy, groovy, fucking... it's the first time they'd done something where you could almost, again... There's moments like that on Life is Peachy, but like a lot of this album, it's almost like a fucking party album or something. It's just so huge sounding. Like if someone asked me to think of like a kind of 90s MTV generation metal album, Follow the Leader would be the first thing I thought of, because it was just so vivid. The visuals are iconic, the album art, the Freak on a Leash video. Where do we start with this album?
Freak on a Leash, one of the best songs ever written.
I was actually going to say, the first song I heard, because they released Got the Life as the first single, and as a absolutely massive, massive, massive Korn fan, I remember buying the single for Got the Life and taking it home and putting it on and going, what the fuck is this shit?
You don't like it?
What is this shitty pop song? No, like now I think it's amazing, but it was so different to, you know, when I was hammering Helmet in the Bush.
To be clear, that's a song he was listening to.
You know, and predictable out on stuff speed. Like that. And then hearing this, I was like, what the fuck? Like, what is it? What the fuck's happened to Korn? It was a massive shock to the system. Massive.
Yeah. I mean, Elle mentioned it straight up earlier when I talked about Untouchables moving them, you know, further along that kind of big groovy anthemic route, and then now of course pointed out that, you know, Got the Life was two albums before that. I mean, even now that song is just fucking crazy. Like it's the one that goes off more than any other track they ever did or do live. Like it just, as soon as you hear that, like it's just off. And there's loads of that kind of stuff on here. I mean, yeah, we should talk about Freak on a Leash. I kind of said Blind's their biggest song ever, but Freak on the Leash is probably their biggest song ever, isn't it? It was absolutely fucking colossal. Music video directed by Todd McFarlane as well, which is just cool as fuck. And yeah, animated. As I said,
can we say it's how, like, talk about the animation? I just love that so much with the girl and the hopscotch and the bullet. It's so good.
Yeah, it was cool. It genuinely seemed really cutting edge at the time. I mean, as I said, the first song I ever heard from Korn was Freak on a Leash, and Issues had been out for Issues had been out more recently, but it was still Freak on a Leash. It was always doing the rounds on music channels because,
yeah, same here.
I mean, it never went, as long as I was watching music channels back in the day, that video would always come up. And yeah, the rest of the album has a lot of that kind of stuff on it. I mean, there's they go back to the Ice Cube well again on this with his appearance on Children of the Korn. That's quite a fun track. All in the Family featuring Fred Durst, like when Fred Durst tries his absolute hardest to like sound like a legitimate hip-hop rapper.
It's so bad. I kind of love it because
it's dorky,
like what it represents. It's, you know, yeah, it's like a snapshot of time and like these two people in this like big genre like trading with each other, but it's like terrible.
I think it all points to just like Korn just having a sense of fun in their music. That, you know, Trey Hardson from Far Side was on that album as well. I didn't realise this, but the kind of the weird little thingy that they do at the end of the album, is it actually a Cheech and Chong rip?
Yes, Cheech Marin's on it.
Oh yeah, I didn't even realise that was him until I read up on it later on. I mean, if that doesn't show you that Korn had come a little bit away from the kind of wretched, horrible, emotional pull they were dragging us on 4 albums earlier, then nothing else will. I also will put it to you, friends of mine and Korn experts, that Freak on a Leash, Got the Life and Dead Bodies Everywhere is the best run of 3 tracks Korn have ever put on an album.
It's so good. Love it so much. Can we talk about that guitar tone as well? Like, if you're going from the debut album to this album, they just really like worked out that creepy but catchy guitar tone. I don't know how to describe it. I'm not a guitarist. You know the one I mean. The creepy noise.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
They didn't have like the creepy noise on the debut record, but then they have it on this.
It was so much muddier. Everything on the debut album was like what I think Ross Robinson calls it, the mud tone for that. Is that Ross Robinson, or is it, might be Rich Ward from Stuck Mojo, who we mentioned before. I think he calls it the mud tone.
I always get those two mixed up.
It's on that Metal Evolution documentary on the new Metal episode.
Right, okay.
And it cuts between the two of them, and one of them says that. But anyway, yeah, like I think Korn by Design is very kind of dirty sounding and muddy, and it kind of bleeds out the sides and stuff. Whereas, yeah, now you've got this super slick, perfectly produced, really kind of fat sounding, you know, it's produced like Jiggy era hip hop, isn't it? Do you know what I mean? Yeah. Like that's what it's meant to. It's meant to do the same thing to you as a fucking, like a Puff Daddy song, like,
yeah,
to make you move that way.
Yeah, definitely. And it's so interesting that not only is it produced like that, but obviously we're seeing rappers appear on this album. You know, Fred Durst is on this record. Limp Bizkit have collaborated with rappers as well. You know, Ice Cube went on the Family Values tour. Limp Bizkit went on tour with Eminem. I actually interviewed Wes Borland the other day for something that we've got coming up in Metal Hammer, and we talked about this kind of general period. And it's so fascinating how new metal really did kind of blend into the hip hop world. And that's one of the kind of lazier things people often say, like, oh, it's just like hip hop meets metal, it's crap or whatever. But it was breaking down barriers in a speed no one had done before. I mean, I know we'd had Rage Against the Machine, and obviously we'd have Faith No More kind of like stepping into that water a little bit. We'd had, you know, Anthrax and Public Enemy and Aerosmith and Run DMC, but like this was a music scene which was genuinely breaking down borders, where you would get fans from different worlds coming together. You would get tours, like, I mean, I can't, what would be the closest thing to a tour that has Korn and Rammstein and Ice Cube on it in 2020? Like, it's crazy what this time did for metal's perception of where it could fit in the world, isn't it?
The Anger Management tour that had Eminem, Papa Roach, what, 50 Cent or something on it?
Yeah, that was the one with Biscuit on, yeah.
Yeah.
But what you, like, this is all kind of within the same 2 to 3 year period, and it's just, it's amazing to think that's happening now. Like, this era of metal really kind of brought the genre into the mainstream consciousness in a way it had never done before. Never. Even when metal was in its quote unquote 80s heyday, you wouldn't see Iron Maiden fucking hanging out with like Duran Duran or something. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. It just didn't happen. Yeah. But yeah. And Korn were every bit as much a part of that as, you know, many of the bands who probably got a bit more stick for it than they did.
Mm. Yeah, it's true. I think it's because Korn, I mean, the weird thing about Korn, like Limp Bizkit are quite obviously it's rap metal. Do you know what I mean? Whereas, I mean, particularly on the Korn, people talk about the sort of hip hop influence, but there's no rapping on the first Korn record. And there's, I mean, I would even say it's not really, Jonathan Davis doesn't really rap. He scats a bit, but he's not a rapper.
No, barks.
Yeah. And he's got like what he always had. I mean, I think even going back to the first Korn album, he always managed to find that same thing that, you know, this was a sort of era of massive sloganeering in metal, wasn't it? It was like, you know, post sort of fuck you, I won't do what you tell me, let freedom ring with a shotgun blast, like all that stuff became everybody needed to have a thing what you shout. And
it's interesting.
He says go.
Yeah. So, are you ready?
Yeah.
Or just
Yeah, or sick up the same old boy, so I dig a hole sick. You know what I mean? I think Jonathan was always really good at bringing hooks into stuff. And I think, you know, like the one thing, probably with Deftones being the only other band who ever kind of, a lot of these new metal bands talked about how they're influenced by not just hip hop, but sort of goth and 80s new romantic music as well, pop music. And Jonathan Davis has got a really, his vocally, especially on this record, has got a really great kind of pop sensibility. Like the choruses are so catchy, even if it's just like it's on, it's on, it's just the chorus is just it's on, come on, it's on, come on, but it's so catchy, it's so instant. And you know, even as someone, I got to the point in 1998 after loving the Korn album when Follow the Leader came out and I'd heard that first song. I still bought it the day it came out, but I was like, all right then, let's see what you've actually got, like what is this going to be. And once I got over the shock of what it actually was and how, you know, how they'd made a run for it, definitely. They definitely had gone for all that stuff you were talking about. Let's be as big as the biggest bands on MTV and whatever.
Yeah, definitely.
If you're going to do that, you better write some fucking great songs. And you say the best three-song run in Korn's back catalogue. Maybe. I mean, I'd actually say four. I'd put It's On as one as well. That first four songs on that record are outstanding. Outstanding.
Out of Control. Yeah, it's a fantastic album. And it's definitely top heavy, isn't it? Like, you know, there's some good stuff in the second half, but you can't say anything competes with that first one of four tracks.
Well, it's kind of the second half seems to be more reflective. It's like, obviously this is a snapshot of time and you're talking about the hip-hop influence and how they're having a bit more fun and like mixing with other people in like the rock star world, I don't know what you'd say, like more mainstream celebrities and that kind of thing, and sort of coming to terms with their fame as well, because you've got stuff like Reclaim My Place, where Jonathan was talking about people still calling him a fag just because he's sensitive. And like, I think Seed was about looking at his son and wondering if he wants to actually like be a rock star, because it's like a lot of hard work and a lot of pressures of fame and that kind of thing. It's like it gets quite reflective towards the end. Like I'm not so into the second half, like you said, like the first bit's amazing, but the second half seems to be a little bit more like kind of, yeah, reflective. Can't think of another word, so I'm gonna go with that.
Do you think this album almost kind of formed a pattern for Korn where they would become like not a singles band, but it seems like, again, there's full albums that I think we all love that they've released since. In fact, I'd actually say the last record is maybe the one exception of this in terms of what I'm about to say. But it seems like after this, they really struck on a groove of putting out albums where they would make sure there was at least one or two like big, stompy, groovy, fun songs on there. And they kind of carried that through afterwards. I mean, obviously they had Here to Stay on Untouchables, which is huge. I just missed out issues like an idiot, but that had fallen away from me, make me bad, somebody, someone, massive. And then they kind of went into that really fun mid-noughties period where they're doing like Twisted Transistor, Right Now, Yo on a Single. It seems like this is the album that really kind of influenced what they would do for, I don't know, at least the next 10 years of their career, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure that that's a particularly good... I mean, my big controversial opinion of this entire podcast would probably be listening back to Korn, as great as I think they are and as good as I think both of these records are in their own way, I assumed my pick was straight away would be Korn because it's the revolutionary one. I think that context plays such a massive part and it's so unique to the rest of them and blah, 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 blah. It's actually, if that old saying that you're only as strong as your weakest link is true, I'm not sure Korn have any good albums. They don't have one album that doesn't have... Some of the stuff on that first album was actually like predictable and fake, pretty bad. I mean, I don't even think Chutes and Ladders is very good, to be perfectly honest. But
I like Chutes and Ladders.
I love Chutes and Ladders. Bad. First time I saw Korn, I didn't really know their stuff so well. I just knew their more recent stuff. And when they played that, I thought it was one of the most mental things I'd seen. I was like, what am I watching? What is this?
Yeah, I think probably at the time it was that, but I don't think it's aged very well at all. I think there is some dreadful stuff on Follow the Leader. You know, All in the Family is absolutely terrible. Dreadful. Cameltosis, Break My Eye, like there's some really bad songs on that record. And I think if you go through all of Korn's discography, like for me, when we were talking about the Slipknot self-titled record and we were saying, oh, it's top heavy, and there's nothing bad on the second half of the Slipknot self-titled record. There's nothing that's sort of, you just go, oh, that is a stinker and I want to get rid of it. You go, well, it's not as good as that absolutely unbelievable run of songs. But on pretty much every Korn album, and can you be a classic album and have two or three songs that are just not good on it? I don't really know.
I don't think that's controversial because I feel probably the same way, because there's five other Korn albums that I would pick at least before you get to these two that we're talking about.
Wow,
and I don't know whether it's a generational thing because I obviously heard these some years after they came out. I would have heard them in the early 2000s. So I wasn't around in the 90s when it was kicking off because I was into boy bands. But just kind of looking at the, like I said, I love The Serenity of Suffering. Issues is probably my favourite. I love Untouchables, love Paradigm Shift, The Nothing, Path of Totality. Like they're the ones that I put on and listen to and love. And these ones were my ones that I bought so that I could find out what metal was about and get into, and because of the massive hits like Blind, Freak on a Leash, Got the Life, all the ones we talked about. But I don't love the songs that you just mentioned. You know, I don't love Cameltosis, I don't love All in the Family, you know, I don't love every single song on the record. It's not like a front to back, I love this record. There's, you know, five other more contemporary records that I would listen to first. But again, could be generational.
So what we're all saying, guys, our listeners have got it wrong.
Actually, I'm not sure that they have got it wrong. All I'm saying is I'm not sure that this seemed mad to say it because Korn are brilliant.
Korn are Korn, man. Like they are.
Like they're, and they were, you know, they were such an important band for me when I was growing up, and particularly those first two records were like, just, I was an obsessive about Korn. I was obsessed with that band. But I do think, whether it be the context of what happened with nu metal or just, you know, the fact that that first album's not dated very well, or the fact that, you know, some of the questionable lyrical content on parts of Follow the Leader have not dated very well either, or the fact again that, you know, so many people went on to copy, because, you know, let's not forget, not only did people go on to copy Korn, a lot of people went on to copy, probably more people went on to copy Follow the Leader as well, like the kind of the nu metal's reach for the kind of the pop charts and the stratosphere, they're not getting that from the first Korn album. They're getting it from Follow the Leader. So both of these records in their own way have been ripped off by, you know, various different bands over the years, which I think somewhat dulls their impact 20 years after the event. I'm not sure there's any Korn albums. I mean, I literally don't, as great as they are, and when they're great, fucking hell, they're great. But can they put together an album of consistently great material? I'm not sure they ever have.
I don't think there's a, off the top of my head, I revisited it last week. I don't know if there's a bad song on Untouchables. So I would actually.
Also, I go to bat again for Serenity of Suffering. And Issues probably. Yeah. Front to back, isn't every single song great, brilliant, but because at the time and the place that I heard it, I really have a really strong attachment to Issues. So it's really hard for me to emotionally like detach from that one. But it was interesting when you were talking about the lyrics just then, because back when I heard them and I was getting into new metal, I didn't really think about lyrics too much. It was just like, oh, this is fun, this is new, this is exciting, this is energetic, I love it. And then you actually read the lyrics for like some of the songs on Freak and Unleashed, and you're like, oh, that was weird. Like, I was, you know, a teenage girl just going, yeah, this is all cool. And you're like, oh, it's kind of just like shitting on me, really. It's like, it's not very kind to women, especially young women.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's a time and a place thing.
It's a different time, but I think there are some albums that you look at and you go, oh, well, it was a different time. Like, or... it was a different time and it feels a bit more... the thing about Korn is that it feels very... like it's so personal that you just go, well, do you know what? Whether I want to hear it or not, or no matter how painful it is to listen to, that is somebody's genuine thoughts and unfiltered...
their experiences.
Thing. Whereas Follow the Leader, there is a bit of like... you know, hey, this is the cool thing to do, and this is the cool thing, and this is how we sell records. And it's a little bit like, I don't want to say it's a bit more cynical, but it is.
It's kind of funny, actually. I mean, not to get like too intellectual about it, because it's just music and it's fun. But when you're listening to him sing on the first record about like sort of people having like tattoos and pretending to be masculine and stuff, and how that's like not cool, and then you listen to like Follow the Leader and it's like a bunch of people like posturing and like rapping and yeah, like talking about holding their dicks, it's like that's literally what you said wasn't cool like two records ago. Mm. It's kind of funny.
It was a weird, like I said, it was a massive evolution musically, thematically, visually. Like, they were just a different band really by then. Yeah, fascinating points of view as well. But we do have to pick one of these albums, whether we find them. It's not just about being perfect. It's not always about picking the best musically. We've got to look at things like influence, impact, what it meant for their career, what it meant for metal itself. So we have to pick one of these records to go into the Metal Hammer Podcast Hall of Fame. I think when you're looking at the discography of Korn, we may have our personal favorites, but I do think these are the two records you would probably have to put up for nomination. It does make sense to me. But we can only pick one of them to go in. So what are you saying, Eleanor Goodman?
Oh, interesting you came to me first. Famously indecisive.
Well, I thought that if you're first, the pressure's off you to make any deciding vote.
This one's quite clear cut to me. You're going to know which one it is now, but I absolutely love Freak and Unleashed when I heard it. I was just like, this speaks to me, even though it's probably about the music industry or whatever. I was like, oh, this is like the best song, best video, never heard anything like it. And like you said, that run of like It's On, Freak and Unleashed, Got the Life, Dead Bodies Everywhere, amazing. So despite questionable lyrical content and a slightly sluggish second half, I'm going to pick Follow the Leader.
Stephen Hill.
Oh, God. I came into this not knowing, when we started recording today, I didn't know, it's the first time we've done it, and I didn't know what I was going to pick. And I think the reason for that is, as much like you, Merlin, probably, I think you're right, Untouchables probably is the most consistently good Korn album. I also think Nothing is really good as well. They are a great band and they've released lots of great stuff. I think this one ultimately comes down to a couple of things. At its best, I think Follow the Leader is pretty much untouchable for what it is. But at its worst, is pretty bad, I think. As for Korn, again, I can only it doesn't have the same impact as it used to, but I can remember the impact that it did have. And I think it's important to remember just how unique a record it is from the rest of their back catalogue, not just the rest of their back catalogue, but for metal in general. The chain of events that it set in place is so important.
Someone's got a bird going absolutely doolally behind them.
I thought that was you.
Not me. That's Steve's house.
What's that? Birds?
A little bird somewhere just going meh, meh, meh over and over again.
I can't hear them, so don't think it's me. I think I have to pick the first one.
Fair. It's a good argument.
I think
16-year-old
me would fucking hate me if I picked Follow the Leader, so I've got to pick the first one, even though I think it is massively flawed. The bird is, that is my bird as well, yes.
Well, I wasn't expecting that. I didn't think I'd have to make a deciding vote, so I've stitched myself right up. Right, I think the Korn album slightly more consistent overall, but Follow the Leader's definitely got the better songs overall.
Now you know how I feel. Steve's argument was so good, it made me question my own decision, but I've made it now, so I'm not going back.
I'm going to go, purely because it's got the Life on it, I'm going to go Follow the Leader. That's what's going to sway me. So that's that. Not quite as influential.
That's your whole rationale. Just one song.
Yeah.
To be fair, Freak on a Leash very heavily influenced my decision, because just that song alone was instrumental in my metal development.
I mean, I should be clear, it's one song when I factor in everything else and the seesaw is completely even, and then I just need one thing to tip one thing either way. And I think, what is the best moment on either of those albums? And you're talking about Blind or Got the Life.
If I had to pick
a Korn song to still exist that I could see them play live, I'd pick Got the Life.
Freak on a Leash.
It's one of the most fun. Nah. I love Freak on a Leash, but nah.
Bull Tongue, innit? Bull Tongue!
Yeah, it's a good tune. It's a good tune, but it's not going in. I also know, I'm pretty sure that the Korn album came out top overall in the Reader thing as well. So,
hey,
going against our lovely readers.
Listen, for you listening, don't blame me, all right? My hands are tied.
Mate, you basically slagged them off by saying both the albums suck, so.
Yeah, that's true. But, read it. You got it wrong. You should have put Untouchables in there. That would have been easy.
Should have put Untouchables and Path of Totality. Then we'd be talking.
No, I love Path of Totality.
Yeah, I like Path of, but again, that's quite bitty as well, isn't it?
It's bitty, yeah. I say I love it. There's like three songs on it, two of them with Skrillex on that I really love, and then it's quite patchy.
All of their albums are patchy. They're all patchy. All of them.
Apart from, like you said, Untouchables and also The Serenity of Suffering. I'm going to keep saying it until everybody agrees that it's a good record. Every song's amazing on this.
I don't think it's a bad album. Oh, no, I know. The song with Corey Taylor on sucks.
No, it's good. You always say it's like someone shouting.
He sounds on that album like a grumpy old man shouting at Korn to get off his lawn.
Every time I listen to that record, I mean, we're not in an office now, right? We're in our houses, blatantly. It's a pandemic. Every time we're in the office, if we ever put that record on, you'd always try and ruin that song for me by singing over it in a stupid way.
But you're trying to ruin my day by playing a song I don't like, so.
That whole record's amazing. What is wrong with you?
Eleanor, that is the worst record they've done since the
No, film. It's not. It's what? So good.
I wouldn't go that far.
Soul, Take Me, like, Rotting in Vain.
The latest one's better.
Insane. It's great.
I think Serenity of Suffering is better than Paradigm Shift.
Next in line. I love the Paradigm Shift as well. Nah. I don't know why I'm not talking about the Paradigm Shift more as well. The Paradigm Shift's amazing.
Because that's got one good song on it.
No, it has not. Right, more than that.
I'm being facetious.
The weakest one since the third one. Korn 3 is the worst. We can all agree on that, can't we? Surely. That's a pile of crap.
I would say the Untitled Korn album is worse than Korn 3, because Korn 3 had All Day On It.
I think the Untitled one isn't as bad as what people say. I agree with Steve, like Korn 3. I remember going to listen to
that. Well, I disagree with you, so...
Everyone was like hyping up Corn 3 and saying this is a return to like form, this is the best thing ever, and it just left me cold, and it doesn't connect with me.
All Dello.
Paradigm Shift is amazing. Never Never, Spike in My Veins, Pray for Me, Punishment Time. Every track on the
named the one good song on there, which is Love and Meth.
That's also good.
Where do I run? That's a great song.
Where do I go?
Anyway.
Oh, no, I just want to listen to all of Korn's discography now. Punishment Time, that's great.
We're all just shouting over each other. There's probably...
I'm not aroused.
We're gone. Everyone's just shouting over each other now. This probably sounds like a kind of glitchy mess to our poor listeners. Listen, we've made our decision, and by that, I mean me and Al. Follow the Leader is going into the Metal Hammer Podcast Hall of Fame. It joins Seven Son of a Seven Son, Antichrist Superstar, and the first Slipknot album. What band should we do next?
Curve Dog.
No.
Curve Dog. Okay. Curve Dog are next. look out on the Reader's Facebook page, the address of which I say all the time, to find out which band we're going to do next. And you can vote for which two albums we debate. In the meantime, we're going to take some reader questions from that very same Facebook page. First of which comes from Zach Wells, who asks, what is your favourite or best or most interesting band name origin stories? This is quite a hard one. I couldn't say that I know the origin of a lot of band names.
I came up with one straight away, but I think it was not quite what the question asked. So it's an origin story, like where the band name came from. I think I just read interesting band names and went with that. So immediately I just thought of Cancer Bats, because when I first heard the name Cancer Bats, I was like, why would you call your band Cancer Bats? Like, why? But apparently Liam wanted to mix a disease name with an animal, and another name that he was in the running was Pneumonia Hawk, which was on their debut album as a song.
Wow.
So it's not really like an amazing origin story, but I just think it's quite funny. Like, I've just got really used to a band being called Cancer Bats now. It's just not even a thing. But
yeah, it's one of those things where I've got a t-shirt that literally just says the motherfucking Cancer Bats on it. And I remember I wore it to work because it's normal to wear those kind of t-shirts on our work. And I remember I went to a coffee shop or something to get some food. And just the person at the till just looking at me like I was a fucking idiot. And then I was like, why is she looking at me like that? And then I looked down at my t-shirt and I was like, oh yeah, that probably is the motherfucking Cancer Bats. Probably is quite a weird thing to see if you don't really know what it means.
I also really like Pneumonia Hawk. I'm kind of sad that didn't make the cut. It just sounds really funny.
Yeah, it's not.
My favourite is Bury Tomorrow, because Bury Tomorrow, actually, they didn't have a name and they had a gig the next day and they were sitting around talking about what the name of their band should be. And one of them went, we need to decide because we're playing in Bury tomorrow. That's where the gig was, in Bury.
Is that true?
Are you serious?
No, it's not true, but I told you before we started that I didn't have anything, and you said, make something up. So I've just made that up.
That's really believable, though. That's good.
You delivered that so well. I feel like an idiot now.
Be the comedian that you want to be.
Guys, come on, we've got to think of a name. We've got a gig in Bury tomorrow. What did you say?
I feel like I've been taken in by a horrible scammer.
That was good. The only one I thought.
And the other one that I was going to say as well is the members of Killswitch Engage had to kill an engage, and they were going, but what engage do we kill? And Adam D said, you've got to kills. You mean we've got to kill Witch Engage?
Fucking hell!
Wow!
Get that for the first 10 seconds.
Oh God!
Jesus, that's awful.
Thanks.
That is awful.
You could do better.
The only one I thought of that was cool was Black Sabbath being named after an actual horror film, late 1960s horror anthology film starring the one and only Boris Karloff. And that's cool because it means, you know, metal and horror are two of the best things ever, and they were intertwined right from the very start. How badass is that? So there. And kid, part of the reason the whole thing came about is because Geezer saw people queuing up for the film, and he kind of thought to himself, isn't it weird that people will pay for something that's scary and horrible? And that's where they made their career, and the rest is history. So there you go.
Whatever happened to them?
Split up. Do you want to do the next one, Al?
Ross McLeod asks, Although Sonic Highways wasn't an amazing Foo Fighters album, I enjoyed it a lot more after watching the documentary series that went with it. It just made it better. When has another aspect of a band or album made you enjoy the music more? But you can't include live shows. So basically, what thing have you watched or seen or listened to or whatever that made you appreciate a band, but it can't be a live show?
I mean, good music videos is a big one. Like, I don't think I would have been so fascinated by artists like Ghost and Marilyn Manson if they didn't have that really strong visual side, because it kind of tells the whole story, especially with Ghost. Like, you can't really fully appreciate certain moments of their live show in the same way if you haven't watched all the little skits they do and you haven't watched the music videos, and you can kind of go with them on this narrative they're telling. I think that's really important. Carpenter Brut as well, in a similar vibe. Like, if I just heard the song Turbo Killer, I'm sure I would have really liked it, but when you see it with that video, it's just, you feel like you've watched a mini film, and it just completely changes your emotional reaction to it. And a weirder one as well, I got into Jimmy Cliff's music because I watched the film The Harder They Come, for which he was very heavily featured on the soundtrack, and he featured in the title role. And that kind of really, you know, the whole vibe of that film and where it was set and the history behind it kind of brought the album to life in a big way for me as well. The soundtrack, which is one of the greatest reggae / ska albums ever. So there, that's some of mine. What are some of yours?
I think if I was just talking about soundtracks earlier today, actually, and I think you can enjoy a soundtrack by a band that you like purely on its own merit. I think, for example, the Social Network score by Trent Reznor and Alexis Ross is really, really good. But obviously, listening to it, having seen the film, does make it better. That's fair to say, isn't it? In all counts.
Yeah. It's such a great soundtrack as well. Like, when you watch the movie and there's that tension, it's so good.
Mm. I think any artist that you like, who then go into soundtracks or sort of scores and stuff, and can make a really convincing, or not even convincing, but can make a good go of doing that. Like the new, I really like Mogwai. I know Merlin's a big fan as well. And
I'm not going to do you the honour. You paused, so I would explain that joke, and I'm not going to.
No, not a joke. We both like Mogwai. But Zidane, when Mogwai did the Zidane soundtrack to that film, I was like, I'm not really sure how, like, this quite noisy post-rock band are going to do justice to the sort of score of a film. But now it's become like an extra arm of their, it's almost like they're a completely different band when they do soundtracks to how they are when they do their normal albums. And I think that's really cool. And again, same for Trent Reznor, just really, really versatile artist to be able to make something like Broken by Nine Inch Nails, but also do like The Social Network and win an Oscar for it. Like, how could you not be impressed by that? Fucking great.
Great shouts. L?
I'm impressed. I was thinking along the Sonic Highways route of documentaries, and it's a bit basic, but probably Some Kind of Monster, because when I got into metal, I just wasn't bothered about Metallica. I was like, oh, it's just sort of an old people's band that old people like. And then I started, that's what I thought. Because I was like a teenager, and I was like, you know, I just didn't care. But then after I started seeing them at festivals and I got into them, and I was like, okay, actually Metallica are cool, and I completely changed my opinion. And then watching Some Kind of Monster just gave me an insight that I didn't really have. And it was kind of that, I don't know, that documentary sort of walks the line, like, between, it's a music documentary, and it kind of has those music documentary tropes about it. Like, there's a sense to which it is cliched, but then you also kind of just get like a sense of their personalities and how they all work as a band. And it just brought an extra dimension that I didn't know about, because I wasn't like a massive fan. I didn't know about all the history. I didn't know about tensions between like Lars and James. I didn't know about any of James's, you know, demons that he was battling or anything. It was just a lot that I didn't know, because I'd just never been interested. And I think that made me sort of like them more and listen to them more, to be honest.
Nice, lovely choices.
Have you ever watched a film, like a sort of biopic of a musician, and gone, oh, fucking hell, they're really interesting. I might go and listen to their music.
Yeah. Oh, what was that?
He said Walk the Line, and that made me go, oh, yeah, Johnny Cash.
Well, I guess, like, when I was a kid, so Buddy's Song. Was it Buddy's Song or Buddy's Story? Yeah. The Buddy Holly musical. And I'd never seen a musical before, and I thought that was amazing, and that made me really like his music. And then there was a film I watched, which was super cool, and it was about, I can't even remember it now, it's about a country musician that nobody remembered who was massively influential, and ironically, I can't remember his name.
Oh, Rodriguez.
Yes, that was an amazing
That was incredible.
Hold up, sorry, what was that you guys both cut out? What was it?
Searching for Sugarman, it's called, isn't
it? Yes, Searching for Sugarman. That film is incredible. Like, I'm so glad you remembered it, because it's buried in my mind. That film's so good. Definitely everybody watch that. It's even, again, that's exactly what you said. You're not interested in the kind of music, but the story is so fascinating.
Yeah, really good, that.
Amazing. Steve, would you like to field the next question?
Yeah, whereabouts are we? If Metal Hammer was a sitcom, would you play yourselves or get someone to play you? And that's from Scott Sittumpel. Sorry if you've said your name wrong, Scott. I feel like I've butchered that a little bit. If Metal Hammer was a sitcom.
It's all right. We love Scott on this podcast. He asks loads of questions.
Hi, Scott.
Hi, Scott. We respect your name.
Sorry, that was thrown at me at the last minute.
My fault. No. If not, I mean, the only actors I can think that people have said look like me are the guy from Jonathan Creek.
What? The main guy? Jonathan Creek himself?
The one who's always on QI now.
Alan Davies?
People used to say that to me all the time before I grew a beard, admittedly.
Is it because you've got curly brown hair?
Yeah, when I used to like have my hair down and I didn't have a beard, maybe. Nowadays, probably a bit stupid. Apparently, there's some guy in Vikings who looks like me that people keep saying as well. I'd like to think it's one of the really big, butch, manly ones, but it's probably not. It's probably not.
Definitely not.
Otherwise, I'll just play myself then, fine. I'll just play me, like, opposite Bruce Willis and an actor to play out that I can't think of off the top of my head.
Amy Adams.
Adams, interesting. We did this the other day, didn't we? And I thought quite a good one, and now I can't remember.
You did a really good one. I was on holiday and somebody asked a similar question. You picked Alison Brie.
That was Alison Brie.
Because I love her as Diane in BoJack Horseman. Like, obviously, I'm a journalist. Diane's a journalist. It's just, I love BoJack. Steve's laughing at me. I love BoJack Horseman. And some of the things she says and does, I'm like, I get you, Diane. And she's also really good in Community and Glow. And we have similar kind of, like, you know, dark hair, pale skin thing going on. So she could probably look like me.
So it's me,
like Alison Brie, definitely. I'm just being given Bruce Willis, am I? Like, any bald man, any man with any butt, not even man, anything with no
any
hair.
Bald thing.
Yeah, so just like a lemon with a face drawn on it, a wheat mix with.
So this will be Metal Hammer. This will be Metal Hammer the sitcom. Alison Brie, Merlin Alderslade, and a lemon with a face drawn.
I actually like what you said about Weetabix. Like,
I mean, I'd watch it. Well, I'd be in it.
If you crumble off some Weetabix and stick it to the lemon, it would make good stubble.
Yeah.
No, I mean, there is someone
a bit of Weetabix.
There is someone a bit more accurate that you said you look like, Steve, and I can't remember who it is now.
Be me?
Yeah.
That I said I look like.
Or maybe not, I can't remember. Anyway, it's weird trying to cast ourselves. Bruce Willis is a good one. He's a handsome action hero.
He's about 70, though, isn't he?
All right, Bruce Willis.
Yeah, but you can de-age people using technology.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Doesn't work.
That's the thing.
And, you know, Hollywood actors look like 20 years younger than they are these days, so it's fine. What a weird sitcom this would be. Well, he's not actually 70. Maybe he is. I don't know. Who cares? Move on.
Who would you pick, Steve? Who would you pick?
Well, I sound like a prick if I say who I pick, won't I? Because you picked that. You were like, oh, me and Alison Brie, we're basically the same person. We're really similar. And you came across pretty arrogant, I have to say, Eleanor.
I mean that I look like her. I said she could. I said she could look like me, as in she could downgrade herself into a mere person instead of a Hollywood.
Yeah, hold on a minute. This is getting a bit self-deprecating. What's going on?
Me and Alison Brie, we're both journalists.
In BoJack Horseman, a fictional cartoon series.
Nobody needs to downgrade anybody. We're just casting for a fucking sitcom. Let's all calm down.
I don't know. I get told I look like loads of people. And it's just anyone with
my Aaron head. Lewis.
Oh. That's a shame.
This has gone downhill. We should put up a picture of you and get people to give suggestions.
No, that is the last thing I want to happen.
This sitcom's rubbish. It's not getting commissioned. Forget about it. Andy Poole asks, a few rock and metal bands have been in The Simpsons. What metal bands would you like to see in an episode, and what would the plot be? And then he's pointing out that other animated comedy shows are available. Yes, they are. Oh, and he also says, stay safe and rock on. Cheers, Andy. You too.
Thanks, Andy.
Go on, then. Who are you casting in The Simpsons? What bands are you desperate to see in season 35 of The Simpsons?
Mine's really obvious. I bet you can guess. Can you guess?
Ghost?
No, it's got to be a band and a plot line. So what am I going to pick?
Trent Reznor? Or Marilyn Manson? You got to tell me if I'm right.
No, they're both wrong.
Oh. I don't know then.
I picked...
So I'll just go, I bet you can guess mine. And then when I guess it, just go...
I bet you could guess. If you thought about it.
I don't know.
I was talking about The Simpsons and I was talking about Blinky, right? So...
Some kind of fish band?
Whom I'm going to pick Gojira.
Right, okay.
And they have to save the Blinkies and the other mutated creatures in the rivers and lakes of Springfield.
Okay, that's good. I would... probably watch that. What do you choose, Steve?
I don't know. I don't watch cartoons.
Oh, sorry. You're so cool. Oh, I don't look like Bruce Willis. I don't watch cartoons.
I don't.
He's upset because of the last question.
I'm not upset because of the last question. I can't think of any other cartoons.
It's not. It's The Simpsons.
I've not watched The Simpsons for years.
Oh, okay.
Well, to be honest, I feel the same because my answer would be I'd probably cast Sabaton on it. So they can roll in on a tank, decimate Springfield and kill off all the characters so we don't have to watch any more Simpsons episodes ever.
But you love it. You're watching it through.
No, it's been terrible for about 20 years now. That is a long time. So I wouldn't cast it because it's just not a good show anymore. And I'm saying that as someone who's been watching it back through from the start recently and remembering how amazing it was.
Was there ever an Ace Ventura Pet Detective cartoon?
There was actually in the 90s, very briefly.
I would cast. Who could be in Pet Detective Ace Ventura?
Jim Carrey.
Jim Carrey? Is that the Jim Carrey impersonator? get another death metal band in that. Yeah,
get Cannibal Corpse back in, that'd be good.
Get animated Cannibal Corpse back in, and the plot would be. Oh God! They have to do something.
I tell you what, Glad. I'm really glad that we're not a production company for any kind of TV shows because we made a fucking miserable hash of it.
Well, why are we casting things?
Because that's what they've asked.
Podcast cast. The cast cast is this?
It's cast anyway. So, you know.
No, not having that.
We should move on. This is
Northern ends out of it.
This has gone horribly wrong. Gojira saving sea creatures is the one.
And then killing the Simpsons. Rich Hobson asks, what would be your pick for a drive-in concert headliner? I'm reckoning Ghost would make it spectacularly theatrical and fit the whole setup. Give me them 50s horror vibes.
It's a good shout, that.
It is a good shout.
Yeah, it's really good. Do you guys know Secret Cinema?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So if anyone who doesn't know Secret Cinema, it's a thing that happens in London where you buy a ticket and you get given a character for a movie, and most of the time you buy a ticket and you know what the movie is, but occasionally they do them like they used to where you don't know what the movie is, and you have to get this character in your email, and then it'll have like a proper costume that you have to wear, and so everybody shows up in fancy dress to this warehouse, and then they have like a sort of set that you go around and you interact with actors and that kind of thing that's all related to the movie, and then you watch the film at the end. So I was thinking it would be really cool to have a drive-in concert that's a bit like Secret Cinema, where you have to kind of like dress up and theme it, because Rich is completely right. Like, Ghost would really fit that 50s horror film drive-in movie thing. So funnily enough, you just talked about Sabaton. I was like, what if you had to redesign your car like a tank, and then you had to wear like camo and army fatigues, and you had to go to a Sabaton show as like a Sabaton thing, which is super, super nerdy. But I reckon people would do it, because I've been to a Sabaton gig and everyone wears camo.
I think people probably would go for that, especially if they're Sabaton fans. Do you know what I mean?
Right? Turn your car into a tank. Go watch Sabaton.
Out for anything. I put for this Carpenter Brute, again, talking about all those visuals and stuff. I think that could be really good fun. And then I thought, you know, this drive-in thing could be fun, but it's hard to really think about stuff that I would want to sit in a car and watch and soak in. So I started to think about maybe, I know this is a thing that was happening a lot anyway, but kind of maybe like soundtracks getting performed live, like orchestras with the visuals of the film. Like, that would be cool. Stuff like Lord of the Rings. I put Gravity in here. I love the Avengers Endgame soundtrack. You know, seeing the film getting played with a live orchestra in there. I know it's not quite the same thing, but that's something I would definitely be happy to park up, sit back with some popcorn and watch and soak in. I think that would be really cool.
Well, what with the old 1950s vibes that Rich was talking about, which I think is very pertinent, you want something, I think, that would hark back to the era that he's talking about. Ghost is one, but recently Glenn Danzig has released his album of Elvis covers. So mind, Vegas Danzig at the drive-thru doing his Elvis covers. It's a shame that it's so bad, that record. but yeah. You know, might be good. Could be a laugh, innit?
You could dress up as Elvis.
Thank you.
Fucking hell.
Bruce Willis as Elvis.
I'm putting it down to the heat. This is going weird.
Wouldn't let us open any windows.
Well, no, I said, what? Well, someone obviously did, because there was a bird going absolutely doolally for about 10 minutes.
I didn't shut my windows. Fuck you.
I shut my windows because I respect the art form. That is it for the Matt Hummer podcast this week. Thank you for joining us. Stay safe out there, everybody. Keep looking out for each other. And yeah, we'll see you next week. We ain't going nowhere, guys.
Goodbye. Until then,
goodbye. Have a wonderful time. Take care of each other. Have a good life. I don't know what I'm doing. Goodbye, everybody.
Bye.
Say bye, Steve.
Oh, bye.